supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a jam-packed show for you cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, we will answer one of our most frequently asked questions. What are the essential books that a beginning gardener needs? If you're a beginning gardener, I know you're dying for this information. If you've got mud all over your boots and you've been doing this as long as I have, make a short list now. We'll see how well we match up. We're also going to talk to the inventor about a great new way to keep birds from crashing into your windows that you can either get from his company or you can make it yourself at home. He'd probably rather you make it. And we're going to take your fascinating phone call, so we better get right to that part. At 1-888-346-9499. Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure for me to speak to you.
It's a pleasure for me to speak to you, Diane. Where are you?
Paoli, Pennsylvania.
All right. What can we do for Diane in Paoli?
When I was little, my mom used to go out to the parks or adjoining, maybe empty lots, and she would always bring this dirt home to do houseplants, and she used to call it black gold. And she even told us how to get it, just scrape away the leaves, and the black dirt under the leaves, that's what she would bring home. And I was wondering what you might think about the black gold compost that we might be able to get free, as long as it's not truckloads.
Right. Okay, so you bring up three interesting categories of soil-like substances. In truth, when we talk about compost on the show, my information comes directly from a gentleman named Sir Albert Howard, who in the 1930s was sent to India by the British Empire to reform their agricultural system. And instead of reforming it, he studied it. And the thing that fascinated him the most, and that he then brought back to England and replicated, was their process of taking all their organic waste and just piling it up in these enormous piles and turning it. And because of the warm climate, within a few months to a year, at the very least, the bottom of that pile would be the rich black soil that they would use to fertilize the following year's crops. And that's how I've always defined compost. I also say that compost is an imitation of nature, of what happens in the woods when trees reach down deep into the earth every year, deeper every year, with their roots, bring up these nutrients. They get supercharged by the sun up in the form of the leaves, then they drop back down onto the forest floor. Now, that material is not properly known as compost, but the material that she brought back from the woods is true topsoil. For years and years, I used to throw out that topsoil is meaningless. It has no definition. And then I learned that topsoil, in truth, is the top 30 centimeters of the material on the forest floor. And because she very specifically took it from underneath fall leaves, she was getting a mixture of topsoil and worm castings. One of the easiest tricks an organic gardener can do is to shred a lot of their leaves. And if they don't want to make a compost bin or anything like that, just take the shredded leaves and spread them on the garden beds they're going to use the following season. Earthworms love the protection and the food provided by fall leaves. But as soon as the season starts and the earth warms up, any area underneath that leaf mulch is going to be packed with earthworms. And they're constantly eating that soil and those shredded leaves and returning it with triply, doubly, quadruply nutrient-rich material. So it's a combination of worm castings and topsoil. And I would say for house plants, the only other thing you want in there is some lightening material, something to make sure there's good airflow, because that is the perfect material for the forest floor. But when we trap plants in containers, it's an unnatural environment. And that's why, you know, I recommend people don't use garden dirt, that they use what's called a soil-free mix. But your material is so rich, what I would do is mix in a lot of perlite. And by mixing, say, two-thirds of your black gold from the woods and one-third perlite, you would have a perfect combination of a naturally rich, nutrient-dense, disease-fighting soil that is also going to have the additional benefit of draining well and keeping the pots a little bit lighter for you.
Well, thank you, Mike. This was wonderful information.
Well, thank you, Diane. You have a good season next year.
Thank you, and you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Greg, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Greg. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you.
And where is Greg doing well?
I'm calling from State College, Pennsylvania.
Excellent. Since we went on the air there, we have gotten such a tremendous response from the good folks at State College. It's been really heartening.
Well, I'm calling in response to a caller last week. I think he had a small sycamore maple tree that he wanted to maybe take to New York because it was invasive in his area.
He lived in New England somewhere, and somehow he thought by taking it from one northern state to another northern state, it would somehow lose its invasiveness.
Yes, well, I did look it up, and it's listed as invasive in Pennsylvania. In fact, I think it's listed by USDA as invasive in most of northeast United States.
And, you know, Penn State is a great agricultural university. Are you part of that faculty-student thing there?
Yes, I am. I'm on the faculty in the College of Agricultural Sciences.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, Penn State is our land-grant university in Pennsylvania.
Yes, it is.
There was a great book written a few years ago about so-called invasive plants of the Northeast. It's a funny tree family. They've got some of the world's most favorite trees. I mean, you think of fall color, you immediately think of maples. But like any family, there's a couple of bad cousins in there. Now, I'm looking here, and it's called the sycamore maple because it has that sycamore-like trait. Apparently, large sections of bark will just spontaneously seem to fall off this tree.
And that appears to be so.
And it's so-called invasive because it sets a lot of seed.
Yeah, it can spread very rapidly, I guess.
Well, you know, I understand that in a disturbed climate or something like that, you've got this tree that's kind of being a bully. It's instead of having two or three kids, it's having 80,000 children, and they're all surviving really well. There's a picture here in the book that is mind-blowing underneath a mature sycamore maple. There's what looks like a ground cover, but it's actually all saplings. So I can see how this tree would be a bully in forest situations and take over an area pretty quickly.
Yeah, I wonder when we get a transition between invasive and naturalized. Maybe when we give up.
Or successful. Something's growing there, according to Dr. Peter Del Tredici, who's the author of this great book. Sycamore maples are salt tolerant. They stabilize soil. They provide food for wildlife. They provide shelter for wildlife. They can exist in a wide range of soil. They can grow in polluted soils. You know, at what point do we cross the line from invasive to survivor?
Right, right.
And one thing in a home situation like our guy has, the answer is simple. If you're scared to death of it, you can cut down the tree. Leave a big stump, leave a big snag for woodpeckers and other birds to take advantage of. But if you like the look of the tree, if it has great fall color, it's got exfoliating bark, it's going to survive a lot of bad conditions. All you have to do is keep weed whacking the little baby trees or even mowing them and keep it under control in a home situation.
Yeah, I often let a lot of volunteers go in my yard just to see what's going to come from them, because it's a lot easier to kill a tree than it is to grow one.
Exactly. And you know, nature's picking winners, and nature sometimes doesn't care about what other people have written down on sheets of paper.
Right. Okay.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for calling in about that. That one had me scratching my head, and I needed a little nudge from a listener. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert you that we will answer what is perhaps the most requested question of the week when we name the most essential books for beginning gardeners later in the show. So don't you be going nowhere, no way, no how, because we'll be right back with, well, we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls first, because I'm just not that kind of girl. I'm Mike McGrath, holding out to the end of the show, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, one of our most frequently asked questions will be answered. What are the essential books that we would recommend to a beginning gardener? You won't want to miss that. We'll also have lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our guest, Jeff Akopian, who is the inventor of Akopian Bird Savers, a very simple gadgetary device that will help prevent bird collisions with windows. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
This is really important. I couldn't believe that we had not done a question of the week on bird collisions. We hear from our listeners all the time about bird collisions, and it just destroys their day if a bird flies into their window. And it's a very common problem that you seem to have developed a very simple, low-tech solution to. But let's drop back to the simple topic of why do birds fly into windows, and are some windows more likely to suffer bird collisions?
Yeah, basically, windows act like mirrors. And so the birds see the outside in the mirror in the window, and they think that they can fly through it. So they fly into, they'll see a tree in the window, and they'll fly in through the tree and hit the window.
And they don't slow down, though, what I've noticed.
No. They might slow down if they happen to see something that clues them that not the outside, but no, they smash into it full speed.
And my understanding is this is a huge problem when you look at the totality of the country, that this happens too frequently.
It happens a lot, a lot.
And as our listeners know, I'm a huge advocate of populating your landscape with birds, because this is something that's been forgotten in the modern world of gardening. A lot of people only think of birds as pests because they'll steal their cherries or they'll share their blueberries or a couple of other things. But I was always struck when I would see a turn-of-the-century gardening book or a gardening book or a farming book from the teens or 20s. Almost always there would be a chapter on attracting the farmer's friend, which was different birds that would come in and eat pest insects for the farmer. It was a vital part of pest control.
Yes, definitely.
Now, what got you involved in trying to come up with a simple solution to window collisions? Because, you know, if you go online, there's 800 different tricks people can do, putting up Halloween spider webs, hanging CDs in
their
window.
And they're all pretty ugly looking, and a lot of them don't even work. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, we realized that birds were killing themselves in our windows at our house. And we decided to, we're a family of engineers and naturalists. We decided to...
That's a good combination right here, right?
We decided to try to figure out how we can stop this from happening, because they were always unusual birds, like cuckoos and flickers. And what we did is we took those beads that hang, if you remember from back then...
I just had a flashback.
Those beads that hang in the windows, we took them apart and we hung them about every 4 inches outside the window. And lo and behold, it stopped the birds from colliding with the windows.
So, but you had hippies walking up to your house
all
the time.
We did have hippies walking around, yes. A couple of us lived in the house, actually. But anyway, so that solved the problem for years and years and years. And then a few years later, we started a book on the birds of Armenia. We started writing a book on the birds of Armenia. And we collaborated with this fellow in Muhlenberg College, Dan Clem, who, as it happened, very unusual, he was studying birds colliding with windows. So I thought we were the only ones with this problem of having the birds collide with the windows. He said it's a major problem all over the place. So after years of him telling me this, I decided, well, geez, I should make this technique available to everyone. So I made a website, birdsavers, plural, birdsavers.com, and it tells you on there how you can make this yourself. It's just paracord, a nylon paracord, eighth-inch diameter. They're hung about, you hang them about 4 inches apart on the outside of the window, and the birds basically see the cords before they fly into the window. And it works. And it's been scientifically tested.
Now, you're calling this paracord.
Parachute cord.
Parachute cord. Yes. Oh, okay. And is that what it is?
That is parachute cord. As a matter of fact, this particular...
So this stuff is indestructible.
It's indestructible, yeah. It's actually made at the same place that makes the paracord that they use to land the Curiosity lander on Mars.
Oh, wow.
Which is up in Telford, Pennsylvania.
I should treat this stuff with more respect. Jeff has brought in some of his manufactured product, and this parachute cord is it's like a lanyard, and the color is like a military greenish...
olive drab, they call it.
Right, olive drab. I should have known that. And I'm guessing that that's the most invisible color.
Well, I think that any color will work, to tell you the truth. But the
invisible, I mean, not to the birds, but to the homeowner.
Right. We also think the same thing. We think that it looks the best. That's why we use that color.
But you have four clamps that'll hold it in place, and... What do they claim? Oh, they've got Velcro
on them?
We've got
two different kinds for the ones we make. It's either Velcro, but they don't last as long. After a year, two or three, right. The weather might, they might deteriorate. Or you can just put them in with little screws and clamps.
Okay, and it's adapted to either one.
Yep.
And then it goes across the top of your window. And how many cords hang down? How often?
That depends. About every four and a quarter inches. So it depends on how wide your window is.
Right.
We custom make them for your window. This is very interesting because you tell people hanging strings in front of your windows, and it's like, ew. But then when people actually see it, that's not their reaction at all. I had one young lady, she said that she can't wait to buy a house so she can put these on the windows because they had a calming effect on her.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
Well, there's nothing less calming than having a bird bounce off your window while you've got a glass of wine at the end of the day watching the sunset and Woody Woodpecker takes
a
header.
It really stinks when the birds kill themselves in your windows. But these are many places. There's some out in the USDA facility in Maricopa, Arizona. We sent them a bunch, and now they're making their own. And they told me an interesting story. They said all of a sudden, a place where they had bird savers, one of the birds started hitting the windows again, and they went and looked at it. And what happened was part of the bird savers fell down, and where they fell down, that's where the birds were hitting the windows again.
So that's like double proof.
Yeah, they work. They work.
And one of the things that enticed me to have you on the show, because obviously you have a little company that makes these and stuff, but what I found remarkable is you really try to talk people out of buying them from you.
I'd rather they make them themselves, because there's all kinds of people out there, and it's so simple to make. You know, gardeners, they don't want to buy something, they want to make something.
Well,
but
if
they want to make it, they can order them from us, and we'll make them.
That's not necessarily true, but I can tell you it's true about every engineer I ever met, Jeff. And you know they're going to try to, well, this could be a little bit better
that's
here.
Good. Or, that's good.
You know. So that's great. I mean, you have a company that tells people to make it themselves.
Right.
And has all the instructions they need.
All the stuff is on the website, how to make them.
And the website is birdsavers.com.
Birdsavers with an S, plural, yep.
That's pretty easy to remember. Well, this is great. I will have to keep this in mind. And the fact that you are really telling people, don't buy it from me if you don't have opposable thumbs or something like that. but otherwise, here's how to make it yourself. Mm-hmm. It's not that bad. And, boy, we could save a lot of birds.
We could.
If people did this. And you're going to save a lot of birds after today. So, Jeff Akopian, inventor of the Akopian Bird Savers, thanks very much for being on the show. But thank you even more for taking this problem seriously and finding a solution to it that's so easy that anybody can do.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks very much.
And once again, that website is birdsavers.com. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tony, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Tony. How are you, sir?
I'm well. I bet my garden to my wife that you'll be able to help me get apples from my apple tree.
I can probably do something close to that. Where is Tony's apple tree growing?
My apple tree is actually my son's apple tree here in Somerset, New Jersey, just outside of New Brunswick, Princeton area.
Okay, very good. That's a very nice area, very very heavy gardening area. People are really into it there. All right, so talk to me about your tree.
My son, about 11 or 12 years ago, germinated 20 or 30 seeds from just the apples. I don't know if they were Macintosh apples or what my wife got from the grocery store. And sure enough, six of them actually sprouted. That year, they grew through the summer, and I left them in pots in the vegetable garden to raise beds. And two of them continued to grow the next spring. We let them grow for a couple of years, and one became stronger, so we kept that one. And now, about 9 or 10 years later, after having them grow in a grow tube, Mike, the green corrugated grow tube,
right.
I've got a nice stalk. It's shaped, very nice umbrella shape. We pruned it only in January. We had a little cedar rust on it. My son was able to diagnose that from his research on the internet. And it's got a nice, as I said, umbrella shape, although it hasn't flowered yet. And it doesn't have another apple tree nearby. So I'm wondering, what should we expect or not expect?
My dear, I expected you to say that it was flowering, but that you weren't getting apples. But something has gone terribly wrong here.
Uh-oh.
Now, you say you're pruning it in January every year.
Yes.
Have you pruned it for this year?
Yes.
Oh.
Just last week.
Bummer.
Only the vertical branches.
Okay. So you're leaving branches untouched.
Oh, yes. It has good growth every year. I put some compost around the base every year. It seems to be very healthy.
Oh, how tall is this tree?
It's probably 8 feet tall at the top, a good 4 or 5 foot stretch of trunk where the branches then proceed out horizontally.
There's a couple things here I can tell you, none of which are going to be any help. But it would not have grown the same apples as the seed.
Yes.
The famous Johnny Appleseed really did grow all his stock from seed. He traveled across the country. He would start a little nursery. He would germinate apples, apple trees from seed. And then he would sell the seedlings to farmers, generally like a dozen or two dozen in a pop. And they would grow the apples not expecting good eating, because you never know what kind of an apple is going to grow from seed. It's totally unpredictable.
Really?
All of Johnny Appleseed's apples were used to make hard cider and to feed the farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously there weren't a lot of, and here's a Pennsylvania reference, there weren't a lot of state stores around where you could go to buy your liquor.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of farms were self-sustaining. So if you wanted alcohol and, you know, weren't in kind of a climate or of the method to, like, grow wine grapes and,
right.
you know, beer was not made largely at home at that time, it was really simple to put in some random apple trees and then make hard cider from the apples, which would give you, you know, any kind of adult beverage you wanted. And the apples, you know, even if they're, you know, had a little bit of bug problem or something like that, make great pig food, and horses would
sure.
eat them and everything like that. But they were not apples grown for fresh eating. For fresh eating, the way to grow the correct tree is to take a rootstock, which is a very hardy rootstock that would probably produce a fairly bad apple, and then you would graft the desired variety onto that rootstock, hopefully a dwarfing rootstock to keep the tree small. And whatever the top part of the tree was above the graft, as long as that didn't die, that's the apples you would get. Your tree should be flowering by now. And unless you're really hacking it back, I can't imagine that you would be removing all the flowers. At this age, you should be seeing flowers. So when springtime comes, are there any crab apples, any other apples in your area, anything you can, just for a visual cue of?
Yes, on the adjoining blocks and other neighbors' yards.
Okay. If you are not getting flowers this spring, when they have their flowers, I want you to do two things if you want to, you know, keep working with this tree.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to do a little stimulating cut. I want you to get a pair of pruners and just give it a haircut. Take, like, literally just the 6 or 4 inches off of every branch. You can examine it now, for instance. There should be buds on it now.
Yeah.
Like, and you have buds on it now.
Yes, I pruned it last weekend, I think, in the deep cold, my son and I, and I saw there were some buds here and there, yeah.
Okay. In previous years, had you seen buds?
Oh, I think so, yes. It's always appeared nice and healthy, and, you know, I don't think I'm over-pruning it.
Is it planted in a low spot? Is it been subject
no.
to frost? You know, keep
yes.
an eye on it. Watch the progression of these buds. And if nothing happens for you this year to show that we've broken through and we're into the right time frame, I want you to, here's a last ditch thing. Go get some rock phosphate. You should be able to buy it in a bag in any hip garden center. It's a natural form of mined phosphorus. At the base of the apple tree, and you could even do this now if you wanted, because it takes a while to work its way into the soil, you want to spread about a cup of rock phosphorus and then cover that with some fresh compost. That would induce blooming not this spring, because the buds are already set, as you can see, but next spring. And if you keep getting buds and they fail to open, then it's getting frosted. It's an early blooming variety, and late frost is killing the flowers. So you might want to start over with some professionally grown trees. You can get some apples from a single tree, but you'll always get more and better apples from two trees.
Okay, good idea. Mike, so real quick then, should I not prune it midwinter, as some other guy I know that has an apple farm way in western Pennsylvania does?
At this point, I would not. This year, you're going to do a little stimulating after the other trees bloom. You're going to put the rock phosphate in. We're going to leave it alone next winter. And then if it doesn't bloom, it's firewood, Tony.
Oh, I can't do that. It's my son's favorite little tree. And it's alien. But I'll do another one next to it to show it what to do, show what she should look like.
There you go.
Excellent. Well, this has been a lot of fun speaking with you, and I appreciate that.
All right. Good luck, Tony.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind you all that Valentine's Day is fast approaching, and mention in the same breath that this year's edition of the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show runs from February 28th through March 8th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, right across the street from Tommy Dinick's amazing beef and broccoli rob sandwiches at the Reading Terminal. What? Yes, it is. And don't you go asking other people if they think that's romantic or not. Hey, they got horseradish and hot peppers right out on the counter. What are you kidding, Cupid? Because we'll be right back to name the best books for beginners and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will answer the request of a librarian, a necessary person in the world, if there ever was one, in Nashville, who wants to know the best books that beginning gardeners can take off their shelves. What a great question. I hope we've got some great answers. You'll find out after a couple more of our fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dennis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Love your show.
Oh, thank you, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well.
And where is Dennis doing well?
I'm in Hopewell, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
I have a problem with some small snails, I believe they're called box snails, that got into my orchid pots when I summered the orchids outside this summer.
Oh.
Little guys are about a quarter inch.
Ooh.
And apparently they do not like the iron phosphate baits that everyone sells as being a non-toxic poison for slugs and snails. And they just don't go eat it, so they just stay happily in the orchid.
So
eat my orchid roots.
Okay, now wait a minute. What kind of orchids were you taking outside?
Some cattleyas and some cymbidiums.
Okay, cattleyas are the so-called corsage orchids, right?
That's right.
The ones with the huge flowers.
Right.
Now, I had a friend who grew those, and his were actually growing in a greenhouse on a big tree that he kept in the greenhouse year-round, a kind of a tropical tree. What do you have these things attached to?
Yeah, well, these in the wild, they grow attached to trees and bark and things. What growers usually do is they have a mixture of what they call potting medium, which is usually a mixture of fir bark and charcoal, some rocks that are sort of exploded rocks that kind of float, sometimes coconut husks. And I buy a commercial mixture that's all of the above.
Do you think these are native to New Jersey, these little snails, or do you think they're an exotic species that came in on one of your plants?
I think they're probably from New Jersey, but it's hard to tell for sure.
And you say you tried the iron phosphate baits, which is iron phosphate surrounded by yeast. And most slugs or snails, I would have said up till now, all slugs or snails are attracted to the yeast and eat it, and then the iron phosphate they can't process, and it kills them.
Yeah, that's right. And outside, there are slugs out there, too, and the iron phosphate does a great job on those, but not so for these little snails.
And have you tried the age-old technique of beer traps?
Yeah, I did. I was not successful with beer traps.
So. Okay. So have you tried anything that's worked?
I was looking online for a solution, and some people said, well, caffeine works. And then I came across this article from 2002 from some guys at the University of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried finding more information about how this would work. Those researchers did mention something about soaking orchid pots in caffeine solution.
So do you have it under control now?
So, yeah, I've got it under control.
But what I'm going to suggest as you go forward is you follow the rule of, as you go forward, trying to get these roots more into the air and more exposed, daily misting, humidifiers, rig up, maybe even one of these little indoor greenhouses where you could keep the humidity nice and high. I think, you know, we were taught back at Organic Gardening that most pest problems are the result of a plant not having the exact right conditions. And I know a lot of people have lost a lot of orchids by letting the potting medium, which was once bark chips, break down into soil, which is a very unnatural place for the roots to be. So I think if you move those roots more back to their ancestral arboreal situation, I think that'll lessen this problem as well.
And when you
put them outside next summer, make sure you line the pots with copper all around.
Right, yeah, I got to keep things away.
You're right. So the snails can't get in there to begin with. They can't cross over copper.
That's right.
All right. Well, good luck, sir. Thanks for that caffeine. I'm going to keep that in the back of my head.
All right. All right, thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Cameron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Cam. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you.
And where is Cameron good?
Traverse City, Michigan, northwestern Michigan.
Oh, sure. Always nice to hear from our friends up there. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a red barren peach tree, which is in its second winter at the moment. I put it in the spring before last. I ordered it online from a pretty reputable nursery in California. It came to me over the winter, and I put it in early in the spring. It came to me maybe, 3.5-4 feet tall, and in that time, it's grown I would consider quickly. It's now about 9 or 10 feet tall. And just this summer, I noticed that on the main trunk, the bark is kind of splitting off, and there's a lot of gumming happening. There's also some gumming on some of the branches coming out just in random areas.
I'm first of all confused by the fact that you live in one of the coldest climates in America, and you bought your tree from California. To quote my mother several hundred thousand times during my childhood, what were you thinking there?
Well, it was actually kind of difficult. I could find those around here, but it was difficult to find them. So I got online and I searched for, you know, where I should get one from, where it would be a good nursery to pick one out. And there were a lot of good reviews for this nursery, so that is why I went that route.
And why did you fixate on this single peach?
Because the flowers in the springtime are a really vibrant red color. They're really pretty. And it's also, from what I understand anyway, it's self-pollinating. So you only need one of these trees in order to produce fruit.
Okay, so I'm presuming you've never grown fruit trees before.
Correct.
Okay. First, with fruit trees, it's always best to buy, not by the color of the dress the girl is wearing at the dance, but for the long-term prospects of a happy marriage. For you, that means a variety that is very cold hardy. And in general, with peach trees, you always want to get one that is as disease resistant as possible. So I think that perhaps this experiment has failed. I think the tree is a goner, and I don't think it would work well for you. The gummy stuff is almost certainly an insect called the peach tree borer. This is an insect that comes around and, as its name implies, bores into the trunk of the peach tree, and then this resinous sap comes out. But in general, that's also something that you can buy a tree based on its resistance to. And you already know that no matter how pretty the flowers are, you need a dwarf tree, or you're not going to be able to handle it. It's going to get too big for you to prune it properly and get good fruit. You also want a tree that's resistant to the peach tree borer and to as many diseases as you can. And then I would suggest you get two different varieties and then plant two trees, you know, about 6 feet away from each other. Even if the book says a tree is self-pollinating, you're always going to get more fruit and better quality fruit if it has a friend in the neighborhood. Peach trees and apple trees get very lonely, and they like to have friends around. It also occurs to me that you live in an area where you can get a very late frost, so you want a late flowering variety in addition to one that's going to be the right size, good for the north, and resistant to the borer. So start again, and before you put them in the ground, go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, go to T and read tree planting so that you plant them correctly. That's going to be half the game right there. And then read the articles on fruit tree care, and that'll hold your hand through the pruning and the thinning that you'll need to get these things to produce real well for you.
Okay, that's everything I needed to know. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Cam. And this peach tree growing is not for the timid. It's going to take a while, but the rewards are amazing.
Excellent. Thanks, Mike.
All right, good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. The most essential books for beginning gardeners. But first, we have to announce a change in your playbill, ladies and gentlemen. Our producer, Alexis Landis, has no voice. It has abandoned her completely, taking her place on his last day of being our production assistant is the very competent, we hope, Peter Christian. Peter, would you please read this week's question?
Sure, Mike. Crystal writes, Dear Mike, I'm a librarian with the Nashville Public Library, where we're about to begin the second year of our community seed library. I'm looking for suggestions for a list of essential books for beginning backyard gardeners, including your excellent books, of course. What a great request!
Yeah, we posted it on the show's Facebook page, and we got some really nice responses, mostly echoing the short list I initially came up with.
Did you stick to her essential and beginning gardener part?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's dozens of good books out there, and having strict criteria is the only way to avoid driving completely off the road with this topic.
So, one of the books has to be Mel Bartholomew's Square Foot Gardening. Haven't you said it's the best-selling gardening book of all time?
Yeah, but I recommend people get the revised edition that Mel produced in 2006 called the All-New Square Foot Gardening. It has even more information than the original in a smaller, much more readable and approachable form.
Does our fruit and pruning expert Lee Reich make the list?
Twice. You have to include his classic The Pruning book. And then I chose Grow Fruit Naturally as the other. It covers almost every fruit you could be enticed to cultivate.
Then the only other one I can think of might be The Southern Living Garden book, because it's one of the few books you keep by your side in the studio.
Yeah, it's got great information about a pretty comprehensive list of plants. When I get stuck or I feel unsure about a specific plant, especially one that isn't typically grown where I've gardened, I'll flip to their entry. It's been really helpful. And I've never really read anything in it I disagree with, which is rare. Besides, this is a library in Tennessee. They should have a book with a southern orientation, although this is a book I do also recommend to gardeners in the north.
And we just received a copy of their updated version, the new Southern Living Garden book, earlier this year. It looks to be even better than the original, a la Mel Bartholomew.
Yeah, you know, it's really great to be able to have a book out in the world for a couple of years and then have a chance to revisit and update it, like I was recently able to do with my book on tomatoes. Fox Chapel, the publisher who picked up the rights for this third edition, decided to dramatically change the format to include full-color photos, and they invited me to make any editorial changes I wanted, which allowed me to add a big section on growing tomatoes in containers and to update some of the basic growing information to better reflect the gradual changes and adaptions I've personally made in the 10 years since the first edition was published.
So who's next?
You got to do Barbara Damrosch and Elliot Coleman. But independently, even though they're a real-life couple, Barbara for The Garden Primer, a classic book covering all the essentials. First published back in 1988, she was also able to revisit, revise, and update it in 2008. Another example of being able to fine-tune a work that was already a really valuable resource.
And Elliot Coleman is the grower behind the Four Season Farm, right? You've said that he and Barbara produce edibles for market 12 months a year in Maine without actually heating their greenhouses?
Elliot is a madman of the best possible type. He routinely achieves the seemingly impossible without appearing to break a sweat. The hardest part for me here is choosing which book of his to recommend, but I'm going to go with Four Season Harvest. It's a real classic. As is a book that I dare say inspired Barbara, Elliot, and me. John Jevons, How to Grow More Vegetables, Fruits, Nuts, Berries, Grains, and Other Crops Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine, was first published by his group Ecology Action in 1974, and it's now in its eighth edition. It firmly established raised beds and healthy soil as the way to go.
You know, your TED Talk on composting is approaching 300,000 views on YouTube, so we have to mention your Book of Compost, which also contains a lot of great lawn care information. And I really like your big coffee table book, Kitchen Garden A to Z, which is a guide to growing almost every backyard crop with a lot of information on the basics, like raised bed building, weeding, feeding.
You know, and Crystal did say she wanted my books, so yeah, I have to go for it. A to Z is out of print, but you can find good used copies online. And since this is supposed to be a resource for their seed library, I'm going to add one more of mine. My, quote, kitchen garden box from Philadelphia's own Quirk Publishing Company.
That's the box with the hinged lid and all the growing and storage information printed on, quote, recipe cards inside. Your book in a box, right?
Yeah, a large number of those cards cover the basics and occasional intricacies of seed saving, which is an essential skill if the idea here is to eventually get the library patrons to contribute viable seeds from their own gardens back to the library. Well, those sure were some great suggestions for books for beginners, now wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put me in the remainder rack if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our long-suffering engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our erudite editor is literate Alexis Landis, produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Peter Christian, well, he's probably read too many books. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki. You know, I think he pays other people to rough up its textbooks so they look like they've been read. I'm prominently published Mike McGrath, and my favorite books this month are Justice League and Daredevil, but that may change by the time I see you again. Next week. Oh, and Aquaman, too. No, really, it's a good book. And Mark Miller's Jupiter's Legacy, if only it came out more often than once a year. This is the time of year wood stove owners are looking to recycle their ashes. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll answer a listener's question about using ash to kill clover in flowering ground covers. Plus your fabulous phone calls.